Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to our podcast where we talk about new books in media and communications. I am your host, Marcy Maserato. Today's guest is Richard Seymour, a London-based writer and broadcaster who is here to talk about his book, The Twittering Machine. Richard, welcome, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So to start, I would love to know, as our listeners would, a little bit more about your kind of professional and educational background, and perhaps what inspired you to write this book specifically.
Well, I mean, professionally, I've been a writer since around 2006, when I began work on my first book, which was a history of liberal imperialism. As you can imagine, going back to Locke, John Stuart Mill, you know, justifications for colonialism on liberal grounds. And this was precipitated by the fact that in the context of the occupation of Iraq and all the calamities that occurred around that, that there was quite a sizable contingent, perhaps not the majority, but a contingent of liberal opinion that was in favor of what was taking place. So I tried to develop an archaeology of this kind of thought. Since then, mostly have written straightforwardly political books. The last one was about Corbyn and his leadership of the Labour Party, which was quite unprecedented. Never in its history has it had a radical socialist as its leader. So I wrote a book about that. But this was prompted by something else, something a bit more personal. It's the point where politics and the personal are very clearly intersecting. And that is simply that I, like so many others, realized that I was probably addicted to this machinery, whatever we mean by addiction, and that it wasn't bringing out necessarily the best in me at all times. In fact, it was causing quite a lot of anxiety. So I was clearly addicted to this machinery, whatever we mean by addiction. There's something quite strange about the idea that one can be addicted to technology and to writing, particularly given that we're used to the idea of addiction as something chemical that happens in the brain when you absorb a substance like alcohol or nicotine or an opiate, for example. I also noticed that it probably wasn't bringing out the best in me in terms of my online interactions, and also in terms of my writing. And I think perhaps just as importantly, it was leaving me quite anxious and sometimes after long periods of anxiety, quite depressed. And I thought this was interesting because it seemed to be related somehow, mysteriously, to the ways in which people become politicized on the internet. You know, we've seen a lot of talk about so-called fake news, conspiracy theories. We've seen a lot of talk about far-right groups building their influence on the internet. And not just the sort of what you might call the white far-right, but jihadists, the Islamic State and so on, building up their audience and their recruitment base through these technologies. And I wondered, is this just because anybody could make use of this technology to the same effect, and it just so happens that they're better at it? Or is there something in the logic, in the grammar of this technology, in the way that it shapes our lives, that makes us more amenable to these forms of politicization? All sorts of questions like that just bubbling away, and I had to write the book. And apart from that, of course, I've been a writer. I was also, I suppose I could say, an academic of sorts, in that I was a student, and then I started taking a PhD at the London School of Economics, finished that in 2015 and was a teacher for a while. But now I'm completely absorbed in professional writing.
Okay. And do you consider this book political?
Yes, but not in the way that I'm used to, and probably not in the way that most people are used to. Generally speaking, a political book will approach you in, I suppose, a polemical way, in that a book will try to convince you of something. It'll start off with a series of propositions. And so in that situation, the writer is someone who knows what they're talking about, has delved into history, has assembled the evidence, and merely has to, with enough skill and elegance, present the data and allow you to reach the conclusions that they want you to reach. This is quite different because all I have here is a series of questions. I should say, first of all, I never in my life thought that I would want to write a book about technology. I'm not a technophile, and this is not the axis of my interest. Nonetheless, since it's something that pervades all our lives and we all use it, we have to have some interest in the subject. But what I was more interested in was the way in which technology is social. A tool is always social. It's always a medium of a relationship, either between a person and their lived environment, or between one person and another. So that essentially, when we talk about technology, we are, in a way, talking about politics already, just without knowing it. So I thought that it would be worthwhile bringing that to the fore. I should also say that the book is probably the first in which I have overtly organized it as a psychoanalytic investigation. I became interested in psychoanalytic language and ways of posing questions a few years ago, partly because I underwent my own analysis. And this is the first time that I've had the opportunity to explore that at book length. And I was very glad for the opportunity to do so.
And it has a really interesting title that comes from Paul Klee's painting. Can you talk about that and what inspired you and kind of how you use that title throughout your book?
Well, I mean, I was very lucky to come across this very vivid metaphor. I mean, of course, in the painting, what you see is a row of stick figure birds, and they're clutching an axle which is turned by a crank. And these birds, you know, they're squawking discordantly, but they are sitting above a reddened pit. And so the Museum of Modern Art puts it, the birds function as bait to lure victims to the pit over which the machine hovers. Somehow, this twittering has become a lure for the purpose of human damnation. So I thought that was a vivid enough metaphor to describe what I was getting at. And although very clearly that indicates that what I'm talking about is a horror story in a way, and that's been the implication of a lot of what's called techlash literature, a lot of the stuff that's critical of social media is focused on the idea that it brings a unique kind of horror to our lives. I want to make it clear that we can't go down the road of simply scapegoating the technology. If technology is social, then the problems that they perhaps exacerbate or potentiate probably are social as well. And we need to look at ourselves and we need to look at the horror that is within us. So that's the starting point. The twittering machine then is not clearly a sort of mechanical apparatus in a simple way. But it is a machinery, and it's a machinery of writing. historically, writing, we're used to writing in its alphabetic form, or in the form where it denotes the spoken word or the spoken thought. But of course, we know also that historically writing has taken other forms. So for example, there were knots and notches on bits of bone or wood. There were, let's say, quipus, which were used by ancient civilizations to account for their buying and selling. They would use basically pieces of knotted string that were colored and would be read with practiced motions of the hand, much as Braille is today. So that writing hasn't always been about representing the spoken word. It's represented other things too. And in fact, if you think about other forms of writing like seismography or knitting patterns or circuit diagrams, there's all sorts of forms of writing, musical notation, which don't have to do with representing the spoken word. And that's quite important for us today because we are in a situation where we have a virtual written constitution. But that constitution, which is global, has not come about through any overt political act or through any mass consent. It's a digital constitution composed of zeros and ones. And essentially, I think there's a good phrase by the writer Cathy O'Neill that all code is an automated human opinion. In other words, we're living through and living with the consequences of the automation of somebody's opinions about what social life should be like. In other words, a relatively small group of tech designers in Northern California, mostly affluent white men, sort of designed a social life for us, and it became very popular. And I suppose the question is then, if that is the machinery that we've got, how can we make it so that the something more than that narrow set of purposes is automated? Nothing wrong with automation, nothing wrong with using technology to design and augment social life. But if you've got it shaped by the values of, let us say, universal celebrity, hierarchy, competition, status seeking, and so on, which is the case that was made by Alice Marwick, a former Microsoft employee and somebody who did a PhD research on this subject. If that's the case, then we might want to think about, well, what other ways could we design it? And how might we achieve the collective political control over that? Because clearly, this is something that potentially is much more powerful than any democratic system in the world. Indeed, it being much faster, it being something of a cultural accelerator, it might enable certain political forces to outflank and outmaneuver our increasingly clunky and antiquated democratic systems. So we have to give this some serious thought. So that's the kind of machinery that I'm talking about. And I suppose if I was to put it in a phrase, I would say it's not the machinery of, let's say, wires and pipes and screens and so on. The machinery that I'm talking about is one composed largely of writers and writing. This is very much a book about writing and its history and the way in which it's being used to reshape the world we live in today.
And you talk about the Turing machine as really being part of a social industry because all of this type of writing is being monetized, right, by tech giants. And then you also talk about, you kind of mentioned how social industry has created a panopticon effect and perhaps a much more dangerous one than what Jeremy Bentham, his original kind of thesis. So can you talk a little bit more about that and how this fits into the industry and that kind of post-democracy and the kind of platform capitalism?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because I took the phrase the culture industry. It's a riff on Adorno's. Oh, sorry, the social industry is a riff on Adorno's notion of the culture industry. And according to him, if you think about Hollywood mass production and television and mass culture in general, He argued that what tended to happen was that in the pursuit of a profitable commodity, they tended to produce the same old stereotyped stories over and over again, and the same old stereotyped thinking, and that it tended to be quite conservative in its effects, in terms of, you know, how one could come to perceive the possible varieties of human life. I argue that social industry, being shaped not by an ideological message per se, but by algorithms and protocols which are in the reality shaping business, which give us a certain range of things that we can do with the tools, but which are necessarily in themselves quite restrictive in that sense, that it has programmed our social lives far more efficiently than the culture industry. You know, there was always a fairly decent argument that Adorno had overstated the extent to which even the Hollywood production line was monotonously the same and uniform. Well, I think when you have a system whereby the algorithms essentially are written the same for everyone, they can adjust, of course, to everyone's unique circumstances and so on. That's part of their power. But nonetheless, we all live with a similar set of constraints. So, for example, if you want to have a social life on Twitter or on Instagram or one of these platforms, you know that there's a number of protocols that you have to adhere to. One, you have to have a profile image of some sort. You have to have a self-description. And then there's certain types of content that you can share, a certain length of tweet, in the case of Twitter, and certain types of photos with certain range of filters on Instagram. And then beyond that, there are the conditions for interacting. You can share, you can retweet, you can like. Likes are very important. The innovation of the like button, which goes back a long way, but which was, I think, generalized after Facebook had such tremendous success with it, turns out to be, for some reason, very addictive. So if you think about what that entails, a sort of a collective like hunt that we're all engaged in, wherein we have created this online icon of ourselves, a little celebrity version of ourselves that is competing for attention and status and influence. Well, that is very different from social life as we used to know it. You know, it's one in which people are very strongly incentivized to have a very atomized view of themselves and a very entrepreneurial view of themselves, in which they are in this big playground playing for, you know, deploying whatever forms of capital they may have, cognitive, erotic, whatever it may be, in order to yield the capital of social attention and popularity and approval. And for some people, that turns into money. It can be monetized. That's a very fragile and constantly shifting ecology of attention and celebrity and status, quite unlike traditional forms of socialization. And one might ask, well, what incentive do we have to participate in this? Well, one answer that the you know, the former bosses of the social industry often give whenever they're penitent and they go on these documentaries to explain how they got it wrong, is addiction. You know, they developed a system that made us addicted. Well, that's arguable, and I'll come back to that. But I think it's also important to say that according to numerous indices and a lot of data, there has actually been a decline in sociality over recent decades. In other words, people are going out less, people are dating less, there's less sexual relationships, less romantic relationships. People are becoming more and more isolated. And that seems to have been coterminous with the rise in depression and related affects. So it suggests to me that perhaps what has taken place here is that at this moment of crisis, when our real life, as it were, relationships are somehow disappointing to us, somehow not working, the network steps in and offers this highly modified and turns out addictive form of socialization in its place. And it seems to be a remedy for loneliness, and it seems to be a remedy for depression, except that quite a lot of studies have suggested that increased screen time on these platforms is correlated to more depression and more self-harm and more suicidal ideation and even suicidal behavior, which raises the question of whether, like so many pharmaceutical cures, it actually potentiates and worsens the disease.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating to think about how it's really, you know, like the like button was developed to be an intermittent reward system. So if you were always getting the reward psychologically, there would be less reason to check your apps, to engage with the platforms. And so by having this intermittent reward, it means that like it's really, you know, it's an attention industry, right? They're monetizing, they want our attention. So I think it's really fascinating that, as you mentioned in the book, where you talk about that it's not necessarily driving addiction because, well, what is addiction? We have to kind of look at that and how is this different from, drug addiction, but also that it's really purporting this idea that it's the remedy to the addiction. So it's like, we really are in this machine, this kind of almost like this kind of this horrendous feedback loop.
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing about this stuff about intermittent rewards, I think there's something to it, but it does complicate the picture of addiction that we've been given, because the traditional idea is that, or at least the idea that's been with us for a few decades, has been that addiction triggers a dopamine boost. You know, like whenever you take the drug, or in this case, whenever you check your notifications, you get a little buzz of dopamine, and that changes the structure and chemistry of your brain. And by repeated activation, you condition yourself to become dependent on that that dopamine buzz. Well, of course, neuroscientists today will tell us actually dopamine doesn't really have to do with giving you a buzz or a high of any kind. What it rather has to do with is the pathways of wanting, of appetite, which is interesting in itself. But now if you throw in the idea that that we're more addicted to something that varies the rewards, that intermittently gives us not just rewards, but actually punishment. I think Jaron Lanier calls it carrot and shtick. Well, you know, periodically you get backlash, you get people attacking you, calling you a scumbag or whatever it happens to be because you've said something that they didn't like. And so you're getting quote tweeted everywhere and lambasted and whatever it happens to be. And that kind of punishment somehow is actually more compulsive. And you've seen it, we've all seen it over and over again, like particularly when celebrities have an online meltdown and they can't stop themselves from engaging with the people who are attacking them, with the people who are claiming to be their disappointed fans, and who are, you know, just often, resorting to downright trashing and bullying. That somehow is more addictive. And to me, that suggests that really what we've known for a long time about addictions, whether it's alcohol or smoking or heroin addiction or something like that, is there's an element of what Freud would call the death drive. Now, I know that's a controversial concept, but the basic idea isn't that unfamiliar. The idea that you're consuming something that you know will slowly administer little doses of death to you. And the idea that perhaps when you look at the cigarette package and it says, this is going to kill you, it's going to give you cancer, look at this awful picture of a cancerous tongue, this is going to kill you, that somehow is part of the marketing. That somehow is part of the allure. And so, of course, there's another aspect to this, of course, which is addiction historically, in its etymological sense, had something to do with devotion and love. And perhaps there's an idea here that addiction is a misplaced form of love. precisely because the relationships in our lives are giving us less satisfaction, are somehow disappointing to us, that we have turned to these devices or to these various addictive remedies as a kind of prop or a substitute. So, in other words, what I'm trying to say here is that there are a few coordinates that we can use for analyzing what an addiction is that will get us out of this bind, according to which addiction always has to do with pleasure and always has to do with a simple biochemical interaction, which is quite reductive and ultimately doesn't explain anything. It's a bit like if you were to try to explain love by talking about its biochemical signature. Of necessity, all of our experience has some sort of biochemical signature. It has some sort of brain chemistry. But that doesn't really explain anything to us. If somebody were to tell you being in love is the equivalent of eating lots of chocolate, which I think actually did appear on an episode of House at one stage, you would think, well, maybe that's true, but it doesn't really explain the experience to me. It doesn't tell me anything about the meaning of it. And we are meaning-making creatures. So if we want to talk about what the social industry is doing in our lives, we have to question what is the meaning that it is giving to us. Or perhaps, just as importantly, given that perhaps there's an element of escape in the fact that we log on and whip out our phones whenever we're in company, perhaps it's doing something else. It's deleting a certain kind of meaning for us, something that we can't tolerate, something that we don't want to give attention to. I think that would be a more useful way of exploring questions of addiction than to reduce it to its most narrow chemical basis, which ultimately leads us to becoming addicted, as I think you pointed out, to these sort of pseudo-remedies, these pills that they dish out to us, which tend to be mostly ineffectual at dealing with the problem, but can become placebo-like in their triggering of addiction.
And I think it's really interesting and important that the point that you make about addiction, because addiction is about attention. So you talk about obviously that the social industry, those kind of platforms, that's they're waging this constant battle, as you say in the book, to manipulate for our attention, right? They're just vying for our attention all the time in real time. And it does move beyond just this idea that it's a dopamine hit, that we're searching for the high, because even more dangerous than that, it's actually creating an appetite. And creating an appetite, how do you, and it's never really satisfying. That hunger isn't really ever satisfied when we go and check our social media apps, or when we engage with the Twittering machine, even if it's to our destruction. So I think that's a really important point to make and to think about, that not only are we constrained, we don't have this idea of free will in these platforms, because we have to, our behavior is dictated by whatever the platform allows us to do within, the technological apparatus. And then the addiction being this attention and this appetite is a horror story.
Yeah. Well, we talk about free will. It seems to me this is the reason why I alighted on the discourse of psychoanalysis, because as soon as you introduce the unconscious, you can bring free will back in a certain way. It may not be free will in the sort of classical liberal sense, but it does offer us a certain kind of freedom, because the behaviorist perspective, which underlies a lot of the social industry's views on how they make their technology work on us, the idea that essentially these are technologies which are teaching us to behave in certain ways and modifying us based upon stimulus response. Well, if you assume that there's a part of us that never learns anything, that there's a part of us that no matter how bad the feedback is, and how, no matter how irrational our behavior might be, we are committed to our, let's say, our symptom. We're committed to that little knot, that part of ourselves that just doesn't yield to being educated, but which is in fact the whole reason why we want to learn anything in the first place, insofar as we do want to learn anything. If we bring that back into the picture, then we can say, well, people are not just programmable. And after all, we can always say, look, there's a tyranny of ends when, a tyranny of means when it comes to the social industry. There's a limited range of things that you can do and the limited range of ways in which you can do them. But nobody forces us to actually sign up. For some reason, it was popular. So it answered to some real demand, some real need. And once we can untangle what that need is, we can perhaps begin to address it in more constructive and productive ways. The framework with which they view the world, the Silicon Valley intellectuals and their various entrepreneurs and capitalists and so on, they view the world in a rather mechanistic way. And they don't really believe that we, as users, have the capacity to exercise free will, to articulate even a consumer will, let alone a democratic will. And we see this again and again. So, for example, if you were to tell one of the bosses of these platforms that the people don't like this particular feature, well, they will say, it doesn't really matter what they say about this. What matters is what the data shows us. If we run a beta test and people use it, then they're wrong. They're wrong to think they don't want it. Evidently, they do. Now, that can lead you in all sorts of problematic directions. For example, if you're on Twitter or Facebook and you see a lot of racist, sexist, homophobic abuse, and some of it's directed at you, and for various reasons, you can't resist the urge to fight back, to type relentlessly, denounce this, to argue with these people and so on. And the worse it gets, the more you're drawn in. Well, the data would suggest that you love this, that you like this content. And so the algorithms logically will show you more of it. That doesn't necessarily tell us that we really, really, really deep down in some sense actually want this. It just tells us that we are capable of being goaded into responding in that way. So we do need to liberate ourselves from the picture of the world given by the platform giants. And that's a process as much of self-inquiry as it is of political inquiry.
And do you think that the tech giants will ever care or listen to, perhaps maybe humanize their technology? Is that even possible at this point in time? Or have they just released a monster that's beyond their control and they're just going to use the data to continue monetizing behavior, even if it's, like you just mentioned, against what users actually want, because data shows that it is, even if they're engaging with it in a negative sense. What are your thoughts on that?
The Twittering machine, as I've described it, is a snapshot of a technology that is constantly evolving. So it will look very different, I would guess, in about 5 years' time. I think it's probably fair to say that what we're going to see is experimentation in new ways of getting profit. So we've seen, for example, Facebook and other platforms look to, for example, offering their own forms of currency or their own forms of financial service. So we can see them evolving in various directions in the coming years. I think it's quite probable that the platforms will have reached a plateau at this point in terms of their popular involvement, in terms of the number of people who will sign up to them. But we should also recognize that they have a certain inbuilt flexibility. So Facebook is not just one kind of service, for example. It offers a whole range of different experiences on one platform. You can go on and play games. You can go on and engage in chat. You can go on and share photographs. You can go on and watch videos of recent television shows. You can participate in fan groups. There's a whole range of behaviors and forms of social interaction that you can engage in. So I would expect it to continue to evolve in that direction. They may offer forms of gambling. In fact, I think some platforms do. They may sort of offer forms of virtual reality experience, because that's increasingly where the next big technological step is going to come. And as Jaron Lanier warns us, when that comes, they're going to need a lot more data about us. They're going to, I mean, because at present they can survey us through our phones. They can figure out where we are and, you know, roughly how long we've watched a particular video and, you know, whether we scrolled and how long we scrolled and whether we clicked through and so on. So they can build up quite a detailed picture of our behavior. And of course, you know, the artificial intelligence algorithms are very good at making connections that human intelligence would take forever to make, and which allow them to manipulate us in various ways. Well, if you add the additional data that virtual reality experience would require, which would be data about our body comportment, data about, it could include data about our heart rate, it could include data about our health, it could include any number of things to maximize the experience of being in virtual reality. That's going to be much, much more valuable data, I would suggest. Now, the complicating thing here, as I see it, is that the profit that they're getting from this is, you know, largely it's what you would call rent. It's extracted from, you know, other corporations who are selling or buying advertising space from them based on their superior use of data. In other words, because of their incredible data, they can offer very, very accurate advertising, very, very precise audience targeting, and they can target an ad to you at just the right moment. So, for example, they know that if you just viewed a cat video, you're more likely to buy the shoes, something like that. They don't necessarily know why. All they can say is that somehow the two are related to one another. It's conditioned. So I think that the danger is that this is going to become a power that is almost as, well, let's say it's not quite a state, but it's not quite just a business either. It seems to combine some of the powers of states in terms of the fact that they constitute themselves almost as political communities. They also combine that with the market control of big business empires and, to some extent, the ideological control of mass media. And when I say ideological control, it's different from when you had these Cold War print giants, you know, like Axel Springer or Rupert Murdoch, who would broadcast their views to mass audiences who would pay money each day to read them. That's actually quite a crude mechanism of ideological control, because people can decide to disagree with it. But here we've got mechanisms that don't declare any ideological intent. In fact, they're quite overt in saying that they don't care what your politics or your ideology are. What they care about is controlling the conditions under which you engage in these forms of ideological or political thinking. So, for example, you might remember a few years ago, Mark Zuckerberg got into trouble for saying that he thought it was perfectly fine for there to be Holocaust denial on his platform, that was a perfectly reasonable use of free speech, provided that, you know, some users found that stuff interesting and useful. Now, he had to backtrack, but ultimately that very nihilistic relationship to ideology and ideological power tells us that they found something a bit more subtle than simply trying to control people's opinions. If you can shape the conditions under which people reach their opinions, then you've got something that's more insidious and far more difficult to challenge. So at present, they don't have necessarily any incentive to change, except in as much as they're under pressure from various governments around the world to collaborate with them in one way or another. So obviously, it's pretty well known that Facebook has arrangements with various governments, for example, the Turkish government or the Israeli government, to remove content that they find hostile. It's also got a series of working relationships with various parts of the American state. So, for example, they will share certain data with the US police or with the national security apparatus. And I think that they're under pressure from Congress and so on to moderate the way in which content appears on their sites. Hence, we've seen a number of recent controversies, for example, over Twitter's censorship of a story about Hunter Biden that was put out by the New York Post, or their decision to post warnings to Donald Trump's tweets, and so on. It's kind of interesting where that leads us to, because in a way, the social industry can't win. And I don't have any sympathy for them in this, but it is true that whatever they do, as long as they're committed to their existing revenue model, there's nothing they can really do to solve the problem, because either they can continue to make money out of the far right and out of disinformation and conspiracy theories and all of this stuff. And they did that very happily for a number of years. And to a large extent, they still do so. And, you know, it makes up a lot of their revenue streams. I believe a few years ago, there was a study which suggested that Trump alone made up probably about a fifth of Twitter's total value because of the incredible storms of attention that he drew to the platform. Certainly, if you look at the figures for various far-right micro-celebrities and for far-right YouTube super chats and, you know, Holocaust denial material, they do very well out of this industry, but the industry does very well out of them as well. So it's a mutual relationship. So that's one way in which they can go. They can prioritize their traditional profit-making model. Another way in which they can go is to defer to what they assume the political center of gravity is. And in this case, I suppose that would mean deferring to traditional Washington, which would be in favor of shutting down certain what they would call disinformation and so on. And the problem there is, of course, you end up with this unavailing oscillation between so-called free speech, which it isn't, because obviously you're not a citizen on these platforms. You don't have any democratic rights. Community standards are not devised for you or by you. They're devised to maximize the profits of the platform. Or censorship, which is, you know, always ongoing on the platforms anyway, because they always have to control in some way or other what goes on their platforms so that they can minimize the risk that they're exposed to as businesses. And we don't really get to the root of the problem, which is it's not that they censor or they allow free speech. It's that they are the ones in command. It's that they get to control it. It's that there's no regulatory or democratic oversight. Now, if you start to pose the question that way, you can see why they've engaged in such a messy and incoherent series of zigzags over the question of whether they're in favor of free speech or whether they are in favor of sort of quality control and moderating content. It's because ultimately their priority is to maintain their monopoly on content produced on their platforms because it's economically extremely valuable to them and they cannot tolerate that being moderated. Therefore, I suggest we need to figure out ways of mobilizing and leveraging collective democratic pressure on these institutions. And possibly, I mean, there's a number of ways in which you could go about this, but possibly one thing we could think about is, if we can regulate them, great, that's a start. It's not the end of the game, but it's a start. But it might be possible to launch platforms that are not controlled by a small handful of Silicon businessmen for their own purposes. It might be possible, for example, in the UK, we've got the BBC, which in principle is a public service broadcaster for all the criticisms of it. It would be possible for them to launch a public service platform. which didn't collect our data, which wasn't trying to get us addicted, and which mainly just offered the useful aspects of these platforms to us. And I think that we might look back on the experience of, for example, Minitel in France, which was the internet before the internet. You know, it was essentially, again, a public sector institution, had many of the same features of the internet as we know it, probably wasn't as pathological in terms of producing trolls and, you know, online bullying and the various forms of far-right politicization that we've seen and the conspiracy theories and all the rest of it. But it was something that was, it couldn't be globalized in the end because of the way the system worked. It wasn't compatible with the way other countries were developing their equivalents. The World Wide Web was much more readily globalizable. But it was popular enough and it was useful enough that it was used by, I think, 6 million French people. And it was available, the terminal that would get you access to Minitel was available free of charge from your local authority. All you would have to pay for is your usage. And I wonder if we might look at models like that and see if we can learn any lessons from them, because we seem to have arrived at the idea, which would have been quite alien to some of the original pioneers of what became the internet, that it has to be a giant mall and that it has to be, everything has to be for somebody to make a profit. Well, maybe it doesn't have to be that way. And maybe there are ways in which we can exert a degree of democratic control on this technology. But we're not going to get there unless we start to problematize our relationship to the technology as it exists.
And you mentioned trolls, which is certainly one of the, a toxic issue with some of these platforms. And you have, you dedicated chapter 4 to talking about how we are all trolls. So can you expand on what you mean, how everyone's a troll, and this idea that trolling it in and of itself is not actually a new concept?
Sure. I mean, I think there is something new about it, but I think it's rooted in quite ordinary human behavior. I mean, we're all capable of engaging in that kind of sadistic way of winding other people up and enjoying, momentarily at least, their bafflement or their outrage or their confusion or whatever it happens to be. I remember in the United Kingdom, there used to be programs based upon pranking members of the public and watching them get terribly wound up. And then, you know, you would let them in on the joke at the end and they would have a bit of a laugh. Well, obviously, most of the time, in order, for conversation to go on, you have to let the person in on the joke and you have to let them see that the intention is not to permanently humiliate them or scar them for life. Internet trolls are kind of interesting in that they have a stylized commitment to limitless sadism and to sadism without any real justification or cause. The only justification for this kind of sadism is that ultimately you showed a weakness. How did you show a weakness? Well, you take something seriously. You care about something. And if you care about something, you can be trolled about it. And a good troll will figure out the ways in which you feel unconsciously, say, ambivalent towards your subject, or the ways in which you harbor doubts about your convictions. And they will exploit that and leverage it and use it to wind you up, for example. But of course, there's other forms of trolling which have got a lot of attention, which are more macabre. There's what's called RIP trolling. And this involves, of course, finding the families of people whose loved ones have recently died, usually young people, and quite often young girls or women, and subjecting them to a barrage of offensive jokes. So, for example, there was a guy called, I think, Matthew Henderson, who died. He committed suicide. He was 12 years old. And they discovered that, the trolls discovered that before he died, he had lost his iPod. And so they engaged in a form of trolling, which implied that this kid was just, it was first world problems. This kid was, killing himself over his iPod and things like that. Obviously, this outraged the family. Because these trolls were turning up on a MySpace page that was devoted to this boy by family members, and they were engaging in this obscene attack. And the more angry the family got, the funnier it was. Now, I think we can all say that, most of us would say we would never do anything like that. But that doesn't mean to say that we can't see why they found it funny. Why they enjoyed toying with their victims in the way that a cat might toy with a mouse. Because, even if we wouldn't do anything as obscene as that, we've all engaged in forms of sadism and forms of, informal forms of trolling. And I think it's certainly true that the trolling subculture engaged in some campaigns that, in retrospect, they seemed pretty harmless and actually quite funny. You know, the trolling of the Church of Scientology, for example. So sometimes we can engage in this pathologization of trolling as if it's something that none of us have ever engaged in. And that's not very productive, and it doesn't help us to explain how it was that this very stylized subculture rooted in a kind of cultural nihilism and generalized sadism became part of, in large part, a broader right-wing subculture, committed to ironizing and thus rendering more acceptable neo-Nazi ideology, anti-Semitic ideology, homophobic ideology, and so on. How this gross-out humor, how this nihilism became a form of covert attachment to pretty outrageous ideas. So I think we also can recognize the other side of this, and we have to find a way of recognizing ourselves in this. The other side of this is the vigilantes, the witch hunters, the people who like to scold on the internet, the people who like to find somebody who's done something bad or said something bad and like to round up the mob, as it were, and generate tweet storms, attacking them and denouncing them for the bad thing that they said. And let's say that what they said was genuinely unacceptable, racist or homophobic. It doesn't necessarily follow that the best way to deal with that is to organize these online storms. In fact, by and large, what we're talking about here is a form of group punishment rather than political education, let's say. And group punishment generally doesn't work to dissuade people of their views. In fact, it probably makes them more entrenched. So we have this dynamic, a dialectic between, on the one hand, the trolls who claim not to care about anything, but it turns out have some obscure moral commitments which can lead them under certain circumstances to right-wing politicization, and these sort of vigilantes and witch hunters who claim that they do have these moral commitments, but it turns out that they're a little bit less moral and upright than they think they are. And I think that on the internet, one of the things that's happened is that partly because of online anonymity or the possibility of anonymity, and partly because of this culture, as I described it earlier, of sort of universal competition and the striving for status and attention and celebrity within this constantly evolving hierarchy, that we have this incentive both to paranoia, in which we always view ourselves as the misunderstood victims, always under attack unfairly, always being denied something, never having as much attention and celebrity as other people do, and it's unfair and all the rest of it. And on the other hand, we have this incentive to turn on others if it will boost our status and profile on the turn of a dime. In other words, people who were, you know, scant moments ago our closest allies on these mediums, on these platforms, if they apparently say or do something that we can say is unacceptable, then we can join the mob. So that we have the incentive to be both paranoid and sadistic. And I think that that's the context in which we've got this sort of expanding spiral of trolling and vigilantism, leading us to the point where you've got people who, I think basically the trolling, the basic trolling subjectivity today is to engage in performatively outrageous acts of racism and sexism and homophobia, and say, are the libs triggered? Are the libs little snowflakes who are triggered? Oh, I'm so sorry. Well, your feelings don't constitute an argument. So that's the sort of trolling subjectivity as it's moved to the right. And then on the other hand, you've got this group of people who are nominally committed to very conscientious views. They're against sexism, they're against racism and so on. But it turns out that they love to don the jackboots and go hunting for people who've said or done something wrong and, you know, engage in ritual humiliation. And I think that that is a very destructive place to go. And the end result, I think, I say in the book that this system has a fascist potential in it. I say fascist potential because, you know, it's a speculation. I don't want to commit myself to such a strong thesis, you know, without knowing more. But there is a potential there in this tendency towards in-group conformity, in this temptation to engage in mutual sadism, in this universal competitiveness, and in the, I guess, the sort of commitment to being on the right side of any mob that happens to form, that can lead us to, I think, a quite dark brutal and sadistic and actually death-driven, if I may put it like that, way of viewing our social lives. And the interesting thing about all this is that it's somehow come about through a major alteration in the system of writing. Somehow we've written ourselves into this state of affairs. It turns out that writing is incredibly important for human civilization and where it goes. And so we might want to think about, well, what else could we write ourselves into? What would a utopia of writing look like?
I mean, I have to say that, I really enjoyed reading your book. I thought it was, you know, as an academic, I really even appreciated, as you kind of mentioned in your author's note, that it's, you didn't really want to bog it down with being an academic work. So this is definitely something that I will share with my students, who I think will enjoy to have, just kind of this well-rounded argument about what it really means to be part of this social industry, to be part of, this twittering machine, and really kind of thinking about ways that possibly we can, perhaps move past the post-democracy, if that even makes sense, if that's even possible, from this kind of perspective, right? So,
yeah.
So I definitely appreciate the book. I really enjoyed reading this. It'll come up in my teaching, and possibly even my scholarship. So,
thank you.
Yeah.
I'm very glad.
Yeah. So as we wrap up, I'm sure our listeners may be curious to know if there's anything that you are currently working on that you're willing to share with us, what your next project might be.
I've mostly been researching the history of what you might call right-wing nationalism. I prefer to call it disaster nationalism because we have seen in recent years the rise of various movements which, for some reason, are absolutely transfixed by and motivated by the image of annihilation. And you see this in Trump's rhetoric quite a lot. And certainly I've seen it in the parts of the British right, Bolsonaro, and the Hungarian right, and Modi, and so on. The image of annihilation, of disaster, usually, you know, the idea is we're being invaded by migrants, or, you know, we're Communism is taking over. We've seen a lot of that recently. You know, even Joe Biden is supposed to be a Chinese-style communist, et cetera, et cetera. And I think this idea that you can have a political movement that is transfixed by, animated by, and actually infatuated with the image of disaster, of annihilation, it's not that unfamiliar, actually. I think this is one of the elements of fascism. This is one of the ways in which I would use the concept of the death drive. But it's also, I think, something that you find historically in the origins of nationalism, in that it's always positioned as a form of counter-apocalyptic politics. But at the same time, it's staged as though it were itself the apocalypse. And you see this with, I guess, what you would call end times nationalism. You know, the theory that at some stage, whether it's the QAnon theory or the religious right, the theory that at some stage there's going to be this big showdown, and the evildoers, whether it's Hollywood liberals or a so-called satanic pedophile elite, whatever it happens to be, they're going to be cleansed from the face of the earth. And the image is that there's going to be a lot of violence and a lot of struggle. And for some reason, they love this. And if you go back and look at the history of sort of far-right ideology, you find this quite frequently, a contempt for ideas of what Mussolini called bourgeois happiness. The idea that real fulfillment, real satisfaction lies in struggle, the encounter with death, usually in a military frontier. And I think that that idea is what is interesting to me is the extent to which that idea is rooted in ordinary experience. In other words, it's not just something a bunch of bad guys on the far right of the political spectrum are doing. It's something that can potentially be appealing to many, many people in quite ordinary ways and spans the political spectrum. It just so happens that it crystallizes around a form of far right politics, but it needn't do so. I think maybe some sort of investigation of that. And I guess this is probably going to be called disaster nationalism.
Fascinating. Well, keep me posted on that. And if you end up writing about it, which I'm sure you will, you can come back on the show and talk about it. Thanks again, Richard, for joining us. And thank you to all of our listeners. Until next time. Cheers.